What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project Podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
So, 9:47 left in the fourth. We let them score. It is now 44-7, Aggies over South Carolina.
That's good.
Welcome back, Mikey.
Hey, it's like I was just here a minute ago, last week or 2 weeks ago.
Or 3 weeks ago.
Well, yeah, whenever it comes up.
I appreciate you coming back down. This is great.
Always fun to be in Austin.
You know what? We're going to hit now episode 51.
5-1.
5-1. We got some more great interviews. Let me take a look at my notes here. We're going to start off with Leslie Brown. She's going to talk to us about whole blood versus packed red cells. Kevin Colopy is back with his randomized control of ketamine versus etomidate in RSI and its effects on hemodynamic status. Sean McAllister is going to talk to us about sepsis using the ESO dataset. And then we're going to get out with our buddy Dave Page.
Sounds awesome. One other quick thing just from the notes of the EMS Lighthouse Project. As you know, we've been co-hosting this thing for what?
Two years?
I don't think we're
even at two. Yeah,
I don't know. Something like that. Anyway,
it's in plague years.
Yeah, that's true. So it all runs together. You know, most of the time, it's Dr. Jeff Jarvis doing all the hard work, doing the research, doing the pods. And it's partially his ADD.
ADD, definitely. Or OCD.
And he hears something, he's got to just do it. And our schedules, they just hardly ever line up. This actually worked out pretty good.
It did.
So one of the things that we're going to do.
Once in 2 years.
I know, finally, right? So anyway, you didn't see me all that often, but it was fine. So we're just going to sort of turn that over and let him take this on. And I'll still be on once in a while, just as much as I am now. But it's just a scheduling thing. So we're just going to clean it up, make it a little bit more tidy, make it all Dr. Jeff Jarvis, the Jeff Jarvis.
And my goal is to see if we can actually get Mike on sooner. I mean, who knows? Post-plague, assuming there is a post-plague.
Exactly.
Maybe we can get back in touch with each other a little bit more.
I hope so.
What do you say we talk some whole blood and helicopters?
Yeah, this is going to be good, and I'm excited to re-listen to what she's talking about.
Yeah.
But I was a little surprised by this one.
Yeah?
I want you to watch it and then come back, and then we'll talk about
it. Because we're watching right here.
I know. But I forgot, they got to watch it first.
This is true.
So you watch Leslie first, and we'll come back, and then I'll tell you what I was surprised about.
Let's do it.
All right.
Leslie Brown. Welcome to the podcast. You have a really cool poster here. I went by, I looked at it and said, oh my God, we got to get her on the pod. Do me a favor, tell us who you are, where you work, and then we'll get into the meat of your paper.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I'm a flight paramedic with Air Methods. If you don't know, Air Methods is a flight program. We operate several programs across the country in Alaska, Hawaii, and all over the states. I'm primarily based out of California, but have the opportunity to fly in other states wherever I have my license. So that's my background.
How many states do you have a license in?
I think I'm right between 15 and 17. I have a couple in the works.
Yeah. Oh, my Lord.
That's a good opportunity to talk about PIASE. If you don't have the app, PIASE, it organizes all of your stuff. It was funny, we were talking about that.
Yeah.
But literally, you can put in dates. You can ship those things to anyone who needs them, and it's a free app.
So, oh, man, that sounds like a lifesaver for me.
So, Leslie, in case you missed it, that's what's called a high-quality plug right there.
Exactly. Right.
See, this is the benefit of sponsoring Lighthouse Project.
Exactly.
Outstanding. Thank you for our gratuitous plug here. We had to do that.
No problem.
So you are a flight paramedic, Air Methods, practice in a lot of states. Seems like y'all probably see a lot of patients, and you have access to a lot of data.
We do. We're very fortunate that we have so many programs and access to all the data in one spot. And Air Methods does really, really back evidence-based medicine. Our clinical leadership and our medical directors are huge supporters. So we have a whole research department that allows us to kind of dig into that data in different ways and see what we can do for the betterment of EMS.
Yeah. Outstanding. So, you know, y'all probably see a fair number of trauma patients.
We do.
Am I guessing that right?
You're right on track.
The sickest of the sick?
That's why we like it.
Yep.
It seems like trauma patients can, like, lose blood. Maybe they should get some blood back.
Yeah.
Y'all did a paper on this. Tell me what you did.
We did. Well, we saw that more air ambulances were choosing to carry whole blood over packed red cells or plasma. And we wanted to know, really, was this the best choice for our patients? Is this something we should be moving toward? So we did a retrospective analysis of the data that we had over a three-year period. It was 146 bases, 1,975 patients, so quite a few patients. They were all trauma patients that had received some sort of blood product, whether it be packed red cells, whole blood, plasma, platelets. And then we divided it into two cohorts, and we looked at the whole blood cohort versus the packed red cell cohort, and we wanted to compare the outcomes. We looked at hypotension correction, tachycardia correction. We looked at just changes in heart rate, changes in MAP. We looked at the shock index a little bit.
Good.
We took it at face value, and then we ran it through logistic regression model as well to kind of see what the stats showed on it.
So I'm a research nerd, so I want to know some things here. Did you look at other products, or was it just red blood cells?
We looked at red blood cells, platelets, and plasma.
So were there any groups that got just plasma or just platelets?
There were. We had 391 patients that didn't receive whole blood or PRBCs, or had a combination of all of them that would skew the data. So the majority of those 391 received either just platelets.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, just plasma.
Just plasma. What was the total number so we can kind of get an idea of what proportion?
The total number of patients was 1,975.
1,900 overall.
Overall.
So you said three. So pretty small. I don't know. What is that? 10? I suck at
math. Are you doing
5%-ish?
Yeah.
Got just. Okay.
Got neither whole blood or PRBCs in the mix.
So vast majority got some oxygen carrying capacity.
Yes.
All right.
I think and we then, had 1,500 received PRBCs and the 84 received whole blood. So it was a much smaller number with whole blood.
Okay.
It seems to be the latest, greatest thing. The cool kids, you know, those folks from San Antonio really pushing it.
Yeah.
But packed red cells has been sort of the go-to for a long time. So that would make sense just historically why you would have more.
Yeah. And then we did a lit review to see what was out there on cold stored whole blood versus packed red cells, especially like in the pre-hospital setting because that's our focus. There's really not a lot of data.
I don't think there's much out there.
Yeah. No, there's a ton on fresh whole blood in the military setting, which has worked amazing and it's super convenient. Yeah. But so it's not feasible on our side. So
you didn't see that massive all of those papers that Dr. Winkler has published from San Antonio. Oh, maybe there's a reason she didn't see those.
Oh,
come on, CJ, get with the program, buddy.
Right.
So this sounds like a descriptive study. You weren't controlling anything. There was no intervention. You were just looking at the data you had.
Exactly.
Awesome. And so you did mention. You were looking at some surrogate measures, so changes in vital signs.
Yes.
And then you said you did some logistic regression. Mm-hmm. What was your outcome that you were looking for with your regression?
We were just looking to see if one performed better than the other when we put it into the logistic regression model. We used parameters like scene calls, whether it was a scene flight or an IFT flight, because that does make a difference.
Yeah.
Male or female patient. Adult patient, and then which blood products they received. So we really wanted to kind of set the stage and put it in the model. If all those factors were equal, would we really see the same outcome? And surprisingly, they both performed very similarly.
So I'm still hung up on the methods for a second here. Did you run the regression for each of those outcomes for change in blood pressure, change in stroke index, or shock index?
We ran it for change in MAP. Change in heart rate, and then hypotension correction and tachycardia correction.
Perfect. Did you, and I'm sorry, I'm nerding out here, did you look at initial vital signs in the regression model?
Yes, so we took the initial vital signs and then the final vital signs when we were transporting the patient.
Okay.
So it's all pre-hospital data.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's get into what you found. What'd you find?
We found that we were really expecting whole blood to just be the winner because logically that sounds like whole blood is better than
the bleeding
parts.
PEC cells? Are they bleeding plasma?
Right, put in what you're taking out. We didn't see that. Okay. We saw similarities across the board, both on the face value and with the logistical regression model. The heart rate change was decreased by 9 on average in both groups. We had the same amount of tachycardia correction. The percentages were very equal across the board. So that surprised us.
Yeah.
We did use those with just the non-cardiac arrest patients, because obviously with trauma, you're going to have some patients that are in cardiac arrest when you find them.
Right.
Or in cardiac arrest upon arrival at the hospital. So we took those folks out and just looked at the survivability with each of those groups that were already alive, essentially. So
when we were kind of mentioning that the outcome measures were surrogate measures, and this probably isn't practice changing, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know. It sounds like your intent here wasn't one and done, you're done with this. It sounds like you were just trying to get some information as a first step.
Exactly. So initially when this idea came about, we wanted to know, was whole blood better than PRBCs? Yeah. And we knew we needed to do a very specific study and data collection. But we had all this data on hand, so we thought, well, let's see where we're at. And let's characterize who we're giving blood to, how it's working with what we have, and then we'll kind of know where to go from here. So this is really phase one of our project. Phase two includes hospital outcome data, a lot more specific data collection with regard to injury severity score, other treatments that are being given like TXA, crystalloid infusions, as well as whether the patient's on beta blockers or calcium channel blockers, anything that, or blood thinners that could alter the treatment. Yeah, but it does give us a really good look at our population as a whole, because we're limited on what we can carry.
Yeah.
So we can't narrow it down too far where we're carrying a different treatment for each group of patients. But for our purposes, it's nice to know in certain areas, if this is your population, what works best for that population.
Exactly.
Because
not
everybody has the same resources and not everybody has the same population.
That's right. Absolutely.
Speaking of that, and what you're limited in carrying, there's only so much room in one of those things.
Right, yeah.
Did you describe at all how much of the whole blood, how much of the products were get?
We did. That was data that we looked at. On average, in the whole blood cohort, they were receiving about a unit and a half, which was actually the same on the PRBC side, too. So on the PRBC side, the average was 1.4 units with 0.5 units of plasma in addition.
What was the, did you guys look at the average, like, pre-hospital time?
We did not, but that's included in phase two.
Yeah. I'd be curious, too, as well. So maybe that explains the unit and a half for both, because it's a finite time that you've got.
I would almost guarantee that's your rate-limiting step.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because you still had patients who were significantly, they were still in shock, still hypotensive, still tachycardic, still qualify for more blood.
Right.
You're just out of time.
Just there.
Exactly.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So we're very interested to see, does it matter what we give pre-hospital versus what they're going to get when they arrive at the ED? You know, does this, our practice pre-hospital, change what blood products they're getting in the ER, how much blood products they're getting? We're really excited about what's to come, especially.
This is an exciting topic. I was just, I'm giving Dr. Winkler a hard time here about not getting off his butt in publishing. I'm not exactly one to talk. I'm sitting on a ton of data that I haven't written. But this is so exciting. He is so pumped about the whole blood experience that they're having. A lot of people are. I think one of the other questions we had talked about briefly is we have a lot of logistic problems carrying blood. I'm a ground medical director. My logistics issues are way worse than yours just because of numbers.
Yes.
Right? We got more units. So something that would be shelf stable would make a huge difference. We were talking about freeze-dried plasma.
Mm-hmm.
The PAMPERS trial, which was a HEM study, shows 10% decrease in mortality. That seems very promising for a shelf-stable product.
Exactly.
We got whole blood coming out. Really, I think you're exactly right. We are right at the tip of a really, really interesting time. Hopefully, we're going to get some great answers.
I agree. And I think it's not just trying to figure out who's the winner. We're in a very competitive business. I think everybody in EMS in general is just competitive in nature.
It's kind of how we got here.
Exactly. But it will give us an idea of what works for different systems. And I think that is going to be the biggest benefit, is knowing that for your patient population and your resources, this is the best way to take care of your patients.
Yep.
Indeed.
You know, I'm bringing CJ up again. We specifically were talking about this, and I told him I was going to be interviewing you. He saw your post and was really interested in it. He's so absorbed with Whole Blood. But he said, look, Jeff, do me a favor and make sure that people know I don't give a damn if Whole Blood is the answer. I just want to know what to do for these patients. And if it's PEC cells, if it's plasma, we just want to know.
And we share that same sentiment. That's exactly our reason for doing this study.
Yep. So what's your timeline for phase 2, phase 3, phase 15.4?
Right.
We're looking at phase 2. We'd like to collect data over the first year and see where we're at, see what our numbers look like. We definitely want to have enough subjects in the study to really be able to have useful data. We'll evaluate after a year and see where we're at and go from there.
I'm sorry, I'm seeing the golden doodle around here, the labradoodle.
He's distracted.
There are dogs everywhere. I'm a dog guy. I get distracted. I did see some other names on your poster. Who are your co-authors?
Oh, I have the best co-authors. Dave Olvera, who's been in research for a long time.
Awesome
and done
guy.
Some phenomenal work on push-dose pressors and the Heaven criteria. Dr. Dan Davis out of California. Also,
both Flight Bridget alumni, those two.
Yep, they are absolutely.
Amazing mentors. Mentors. I'm relatively new in the research field, and I'm just learning as much as I can from them. And then Caitlin Price and Laura Smith are both flight nurses out of Florida that also work for Air Methods. Being a big company, we have relationships across the state, so it's kind of nice that California, the East and the West, are all working together on this project.
Yep.
Well, I'm kind of glad because do you have any Texas bases?
We do.
And are they included in this?
They are.
So I really was kind of concerned that Texas and California working together, kind of like antimatter and matter. So nothing exploded.
No, nothing exploded. No toxic fumes were encountered.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us. This was great information. I think our listeners, maybe our watchers, because we're on YouTube too, are really going to like this. Thanks so much. We're looking forward to seeing more from you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Thanks.
All right. Outstanding job, Leslie.
Good
really
stuff.
Impressed.
Yep.
Great presentation. You clearly know the material. This is great stuff, but it is a little surprising. You know, Mikey, you had mentioned you were a little shocked. What was that?
Well, I mean, just Whole Blood's supposed to be the bee's knees, right? I still think it is. I don't think we throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to find that really they were sort of
equivalent,
right? And I think it's everyone knows the challenges of carrying Whole Blood.
Sure.
Maybe there's something to the carrying the parts instead.
Well, I will point out some limitations here. So these were all surrogate measures, just like Leslie pointed out. The future work is going to look at outcomes information.
Yeah.
That's one. The other thing is that we still have the problems of maintenance and logistics with packed red cells, with everything except... here's my hope. Come on, freeze-dried plasma.
Yeah, exactly.
Or maybe we'll eventually get to, you know, nirvana and get that oxygen-carrying capacity in something stable.
Right.
But I think this is great information, and I'm really looking forward to what Leslie and Dr. Davis and the folks with
Air Methods
come up with next.
Yep.
Well, speaking of next, let's go back to Kevin and talk about RSI. Y'all may have heard. Have you heard this?
There's a couple things I heard. One, Texas is a delegated practice state.
Texas is a delegated practice. Drink up, Joseph.
Two, it's an airway thing.
It is. And I kind of like airways. Yeah. I'm an airway nerd.
I've heard about that.
So we're going to talk ketamine versus etomidate. What do you got, Kevin?
Let's go.
Kevin, welcome back to our increasingly noisy podcast studio.
It gives us some flavor. And excitement. I love
excitement.
It.
Yes. I can feel the
Everyone's trying
here.
To come in and hear what you're talking about.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Well, you're here, and they're hearing, there are two words that they're hearing. They're hearing ketamine, and they're hearing etomidate, and they're like, I have got to know about this.
Exactly.
Boy, has that become the hot topic in the United States, particularly when you add the next phrase, EMS.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then never mind. That's a second shift.
Well, I'll tell you what. Since I'm an airway nerd, I kind of like ketamine. I like etomidate.
Yeah.
I got a question. I have a patient. Let's just ignore the fact that I'm going to resuscitate my patient before I intubate them. Put that aside. We got a great academic question. everybody knows that if your patient is hemodynamically unstable, ketamine is the drug to use. We should definitely use that over etomidate.
Just every time.
Everybody knows that. So anytime I say everybody knows, that's sarcasm.
Yeah.
So, and you should never give ketamine if they've got increased ICP because you're going to jack their blood pressure.
Yes.
Never do that.
No. And I was hearing that all the time in 2015 from my team. My critical care pharmacists were hearing that all the time from my team. Well, I couldn't give them that drug because.
Right.
And they looked at them and said,
not so much.
Where are you getting this from?
Yeah,
I thought we took care of that. There was some research. Anyway.
So tell us about your paper. What's your, what did you do and what did you find?
Yeah, so we're pretty excited by this. We've run a randomized clinical trial directly comparing the use of ketamine or etomidate for induction during rapid sequence intubation. And I love your plug about appropriate resuscitation because we now have all of that in our protocols too, and I think that's so important. You had a separate conversation probably from today. But we tried to keep this pure of asking the question of current state, do we change patient hemodynamics when we're using one drug or the other? We previously looked at this in a retrospective study, but we were really concerned that there'd be lots of bias just based on what you just described of our providers picking ketamine or etomidate because of assumptions that might not be based in fact.
And almost all of the literature that's out there is observational and very much subject to that indication bias. And, you know, there is a way to deal with indication bias, and that's a randomized controlled trial. So sounds like you did it.
Yeah. So we got IRB approval. And we started enrolling patients in 2017. And so we actually did a dual-arm study, but we're only talking about the pre-hospital data today. So the IRB approval was for in the emergency department and the field.
So those are the two arms.
Those are the two arms. So we can go back and compare physician use versus pre-hospital use to see if there's a difference there as well. So we have about a little over 500 patients in the overall study. But kind of backing up a little, so we randomized our patients from January 1st, 2018 through August 2019 on every even date, even is etomidate, every even date, any patient who needed rapid sequence intubation was induced 0.3 milligrams per kilogram of etomidate.
Okay.
On every odd date of dispatch, patients received 2 milligrams per kilogram of ketamine. To keep it pure, we used one drug dose so you couldn't titrate, you couldn't look at, oh, I'm going to half the dose because they're in shock. Those are all great questions, but
not
different questions.
That
we wanted to keep
problems.
It clean.
Yeah.
Right.
So what was your, come back and tell us exactly who you were including and were there any exclusion criteria?
So we included we collected data on every pre-hospital intubation and then we studied every patient who was intubated via rapid sequence intubation. And we excluded minors, prisoners, all of the typical at-risk populations were understandably excluded.
Yep.
And we studied the first sets of vital signs. We were particularly then our question at hand was, do we get hypotension, a 20% drop in blood pressure, it's a common accepted significant change in vital signs, and do we have a significant change in shock index? So those were our two factors that we were looking at in our study, and then first pass success, everything else that you kind of look at as secondary questions throughout the study period.
So your primary outcome was your delta blood pressure before and after?
Yes.
Before the drug and after the drug.
Yes. So we looked at last set of vital signs before intubation.
Okay.
And then we monitored the patient for up to 15 minutes after induction, but we stopped if any additional sedatives were given.
Okay.
So if I gave more ketamine or I gave propofol or I gave Versed,
something
God
else
forbid someone gives more
pressure.
Etomidate, that's a different conversation, but they shouldn't have in our protocols. You don't double dose etomidate. That's, I think, well known at this point in time.
Their adrenal glands will clearly spontaneously combust.
Yes.
Right, but it's not a good practice to be in. If you need it, you need it. We all know it happens. But we stopped at that point so we didn't mix in other drugs that could really mess with blood pressure. And we did look at, did you get any analgesia afterwards?
Okay.
What other kind of supportive drugs did you get? So we had it up to about 20-minute period of time we were monitoring the patient for changes in hemodynamics. We ended up enrolling 195 patients in the study. It was, and I'm just kind of, sorry, I'm scrolling through my slides, 92 in the etomidate arm and 103 in the ketamine arm.
Not bad,
so
not bad.
So a reasonable study. Yeah. We are going back, and we have a subset of patients that we excluded because they got wrong drug, wrong date.
And you were doing this as an intention to treat analysis,
correct.
Right?
Correct. So, yep. Okay. So because it was intent to treat, We're allowed to go back, and we are going to include those patients now that we've gotten IRB clearance to do so. It's not really a new approval, but they approved us going back and reanalyzing these patients as a subset just to make sure the results I'm about to talk about weren't influenced by some bias.
So you went back in and you looked at it as both an intention to treat and a per protocol and what was actually delivered.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. What'd you find?
So what we found is that our patient groups were very homogenous. So there were no differences between the groups. And that's really important.
Yeah, table same one looks
age,
boring.
Same age, same gender mix, same shock index mix, same reasons for RSI. No statistical differences between the two groups. Sure, there's some percentage differences, but no p-value that said there's a significant difference between them.
Baseline characteristics are good.
Exactly. So no difference in baseline GCS. Average shock index between the two groups in the etomidate group was 0.79. 0.88 in the ketamine group. P-value was just over 0.1, so not different there as well. It sounds like the ketamine's a little bit higher, but not statistically higher.
Yep.
So we look at our results. In the 0 to 7 minutes, no difference in our patients. They stayed the same. Didn't matter which drug was given. There were changes. We did see understandable drops in blood pressure, but no significant increased drop one drug versus the other.
Yep.
We actually saw some delayed changes, and we saw a trend towards a lower systolic blood pressure and a lower mean arterial pressure in the 8 to 15 minutes afterwards. Those reached statistical significance.
With ketamine.
With ketamine. With so ketamine was low, had a lower. However, our frequency of hypotension, that 20% drop in blood pressure, did not reach statistical significance.
Okay.
So we had no statistical difference in the percentage of blood pressure changes or percentage of patients who had blood pressure changes between the two groups. We then did a couple of sub-analyses of our patients who were hypotensive, had any hypotension, and our patients with any high shock index. And we looked at those groups
because
and we found the same thing.
That's been a thing in the literature, particularly with ketamine.
Correct. So when we looked at those subgroups, we again found no statistical significant difference between the populations, with the exception of in the high shock index group, systolic blood pressure following ketamine was lower with a p-value of 0.007. So that wasn't our primary objective. The presence of hypotension wasn't there. We didn't see more hypotension as we defined it in the ketamine group with a high shock index.
Awesome.
But we did see a lower blood pressure compared to etomidate. So what we concluded based on our pre-hospital data is there was no hemodynamic difference between the two drugs regardless of the patient's physiologic state, whether you choose etomidate or ketamine in this particular study.
Yeah. And so I like this. There has been an RCT, essentially that RCT, done in the hospital. And they found exactly the same thing. No significant differences. The big question is, well, does that exist in the field?
Right.
Is there anything different? So it's really nice. I think it's a great confirmatory paper. And the fact that you're doing this in two arms, field and ED, in the same setting. So as opposed to, I think the other one was Jabre. So she's a French doc. So this is now same country, same system. The practices should be the same. It'll be really interesting to compare your EMS findings and your ED findings.
Yes. So I don't have that data here today. I don't want to throw any spoilers out there.
Sure.
We've got the data aggregated. We are looking at that, and we're really looking at three papers to come out. Just emergency department, just EMS, and then all of it combined. So you're going to see three papers coming out in the next year. We got a whole team of people working on it. I'm just one of the representatives. I happen to be the pre-hospital guy, so I get to come talk about
Absolutely.
Our pre-hospital data,
and
it's really exciting. And you know, we are really hoping that now that we've looked at this in a single system, New Hanover Regional Medical Center owns local countywide EMS, so we had it in one county, and my critical care transport team touches patients in seven counties. So we had patients from the surrounding counties. So we had a large geographic spread, but really only one system. So what I'm really hoping to do next is get two or three other hospitals to can we do the same study, but across a larger geographic spread at the same time. Let's really be confident in saying that there's no difference between the two drugs. Or did I have a locality bias? Do I have information that's skewing our results so we don't want to make that absolute conclusion? And I think it's important to say this is one study. Yes,
single
it's
center.
Randomized, but we can't say this is not a landmark study. This is not something that should change all of our practice, but it should give us confidence.
Yeah.
Whichever drug you're using, you're probably doing okay.
Absolutely. What's your takeaway tweet?
So, I think there's a bunch of them in this study, and I think our biggest difference is both drugs in RSI are equally unsafe. So I would say ketamine or etomidate, question mark, both are equally unsafe in RSI.
So that's what I was hoping you were going to say, because that's one of the things. I think you're being overly cynical in your approach, but I think you make a good point. I think the danger, and this is the same thing that Dr. Fernandez and Crow found with their ketamine study, is we have an assumption that ketamine is completely safe, and it turns out it's not. It's probably a reasonable drug. It turns out if you need to be intubated, you're probably not the healthiest in the world. But you still need to be intubated, and we have to use something, and we need to be informed about that. Right. So I think this is great work. I'm really, really excited about it. I'm looking forward to reading the paper. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Happy to be on.
Excellent.
Appreciate
job,
it.
Brother. Good seeing you again.
You too.
All right.
Good
take
job,
care.
Buddy.
All right. Well, thanks, Kevin, again. Appreciate you swinging by the booth twice to talk to us about your research. And, I think it's just another study looking at ketamine, and it's just not everything people think it is, right? And so...
Well, so, you know, our buddy Dave Olvera mm-hmm. did a study on this.
Yep.
And the takeaway was that from a lot of people, I don't think Dave was saying this. Wow. Incoming.
Leave that in there.
But it was that ketamine does not fix hypotension.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, it duh.
Well, no.
It's not supposed to.
Well, I know.
And that's the problem, is that people put a halo on it.
Exactly.
A little unicorn horn. Yep. And, yeah, it's a drug like any other drug.
Right. Well, it's easy. I'm going to give some ketamine, and that's going to bump their blood pressure and their heart rate. Well, what if there's nothing left to give?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. It's
yeah.
not going to work.
I think we just need to recognize that ketamine is a really, really good drug, but it's not a mixture of an induction agent and a vasopressor and glucose and a steroid and, right. you know, I don't know, something great.
Right.
I mean, it's not droperidol after all. Anyway, great work. And this is very consistent with other work that has been done.
Indeed.
Let's go next to Sean McAllister and find out about some sepsis using a wonderful data set.
The ESO data set.
The ESO data set. A great plug out for ESO, who does not sponsor us.
Nope.
Perhaps they should.
Perhaps.
But they have a wonderful data set, and really, I really do appreciate them making this data set available to the research community. We are learning a massive amount from this.
Yeah.
Thank you guys very much. Let's hit it. Sean.
All right. Sean, thank you so much for joining us. Let's talk some sepsis, shall we?
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. I'm glad to see you here. This is exciting stuff. I'm really interested in what you have found out here. So first off, if you don't mind, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you came in contact with this data set.
Sure. So my name is Sean McAllister. I'm a current Master's of Public Health student at Boston University, interested in EMS research, so specializing in epidemiology and biostatistics right now. So that led me, when in my senior year of college, being like, I don't know what I want to do with my life, approaching my medical director to kind of figure out, you know, how do I combine these two aspects of my life, research and EMS?
So let me go back and ask you about that.
Sure.
EMS. So you have a background in EMS.
I do. I've been a basic for about 3 years working at a 911 ALS service.
Perfect.
So approached my medical director, wanted to combine it. I said, well, what do you got for me? And he said, I got the perfect contact for you, and gave me Dr. Remley Crowe's contact information, and we've been working on this project ever since.
Awesome. You have a wise medical director to hook you up with.
Yeah, right. I do indeed.
Right. Awesome. So tell us about this project. What'd you look at, and what'd you find?
Yeah, so we looked at, you know, in the field, we know that sepsis is a really important issue, that we see a lot of those patients. It's really prevalent in the hospital. And we wanted to know, well, how good are we as a profession at recognizing sepsis in the field? And when we do recognize sepsis, what are the implications on patient outcome?
Kind of the most important question.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, tell us about your methods.
So what we did is we used the ESO Data Collaborative data set, which links ICD-10 codes, so hospital chart records, with the pre-hospital care record, so that we know what the outcomes of these patients that we drop off are. So with that in mind, we used patients with a primary secondary impression of sepsis, any part of the septic specialty form on the ESO platform that was filled out or that they triggered a septic alert, and we lined that up with the ones out of the hospital that had a septic ICD-10 code. And we looked at identification and then patient outcome based off of those linked charts.
Perfect. So your inclusion criteria to filter through the data set was based on ICD-10 code, right?
And septic patients in the pre-hospital setting that had a linked ICD-10 code.
Perfect. So that's your population.
Yes.
And then you were looking, it sounds like the one of the things you were looking for is, did EMS recognize it?
Yes.
Using those the things that you described,
yes.
Primary, secondary, perfect.
You got it.
So ESO, just in case the group isn't familiar with that data set, there are some specialty forms that you can use to identify, and I believe they have both QSOFA and SIRS, right?
They do. Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect.
And we took a liberal definition with that. It doesn't mean they had to be positive or negative on those scales, as long as they filled out something on that scale, just to kind of...
There was a hint.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's a suspicion of cause was there.
Yeah, okay. Kind of like, well, if you did a 12 lead, you might have been thinking about their heart.
Right, exactly.
Reasonable. So you got that set up, and then what kind of statistical analysis did you do, and what did you find out?
So we did descriptive statistics, and then did a Wilcoxon rank sum and chi-squared, and then did multivariable logistic regression models, which is a lot of jargon, but...
I want to know, what did you use chi-square on, and why the Wilcoxon rank sum?
So I would have to...
Because if I keep asking people this, maybe I'll learn it at one point, and we'll have to not keep bugging.
And that's
bugging
the thing,
Rimley.
Too, is I haven't necessarily come into that part in my education yet, so I'd have to...
Fair enough.
You know, pawn that out to Remley, but
exactly
she's
the
senior statistician on the project. Let's put
it
that way.
Fair enough. I guess the most important question is, what statistical programming package did you use?
So she uses Stata.
What did you use?
I use R in my studies.
Outstanding. The interview can continue. Good answer. Good answer. Down with Stata. All right, perfect. So this is a constant thing. I'm an R guy. She's a Stata gal. So
you have to have that fight, you know, constantly.
Absolutely. So tell us what you found.
Absolutely. So we would expect that, you know, we get called to the nursing home quite a lot. You know, there's always the index of suspicion there. We would expect pretty high recognition of septic patients. However, it's actually only about 22%, which is less than 1 in 4 patients. So less than 1 in 4 septic patients that we come in contact with are we actually identifying. And moreover from that, our septic shock patients, which have an even worse presentation to us, we would think it'd be easier to identify because they're in shock. All right, well, let's do all the treatments. We have our suspicion of it.
The hypotension might have clued you in.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
It's actually marginally better. It's only 24%, which is still less than 1 in 4 septic shock patients are we catching in the field.
Yep. And so what? What does it matter if we identify them in the field or not?
So there's a couple of things I want to answer that with. It's been established in the literature that EMS does play a vital role in the early treatment of sepsis. Not only can we start giving them fluids, can we give them vasopressors, but what else we can do is we can trigger that septic shock alert at the hospital. That way, boom, they're ready. They're going down that course already. We can get a shorter time to antibiotics. And that's the key there, because the shortest time to antibiotics is the number one thing that we can do as providers to help septic patients. So if we can do that in the field and we do that well, we hopefully can establish that shorter time to antibiotics. However, with that in mind...
And the reason we care about antibiotics is because of ultimate outcome, which is mortality.
Right.
And you looked at that.
We did. And when EMS catches sepsis, there's a 51% reduction in odds of patient mortality. So it's really, really important that we are catching these sick patients.
So you said a 51% reduction. So you looked, you did an adjusted.
We did. That was our adjusted.
Adjusted odds ratio of 0.49. Did I get the math right?
Yes, I believe so.
So that's kind of important.
It is.
I think that's an important finding. So give me, if you will, a tweet version. What's your tweet about that sums up this case and tells us why it's important and what we should do with it?
So my tweet would be, EMS as a profession is catching less than 1 in 4 septic patients. And we need to come up with better ways to be able to catch that, because when we do catch it, we do see a significant impact on patient mortality. We do make a difference. So we do need to be able to come up with better ways to be able to catch those septic patients.
Sean, I think you just teed up on that. That is a beautiful tweet, a great summary of your work. I really do think this is important. It is a clear opportunity for improvement, whether the improvement is better documentation of our concerns of sepsis, or is, unfortunately, I suspect, actual recognition.
Right.
But we got to do a better job, and I think you've made a great case for it.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Nice job.
Appreciate it.
Great job, Sean. I was very impressed.
Good stuff.
Yep. Good stuff. Great presentation. You're clearly very well prepared. It's not surprising. Rimley picked a great student to work with. You're doing wonderful things. I think that you really demonstrated your outstanding judgment in the choice of statistical programming packages.
Yes, yes.
R for the win, baby. Mm. Great job. Seriously, man, you did a good job. Let's wrap it up now. Since we're talking about a bunch of research that has been published and presented at the PCRF, let's go to Dave Page. We're going to talk about PCRF. And then we're going to talk about some research he did comparing curricula in the U.S. to curricula in Mexico. Kind of surprising about really how they train EMTs versus how we do it.
Interesting. I wasn't privy to this one, so let's watch
this. This was an after. I caught him as he was headed out to the hotel. I tripped him. Said, Dave, you got to help me out.
Perfect.
Dave.
Jeff.
Thank you for joining us, man.
It is my pleasure.
We're still here at Expo. The Exposition Center has closed. We got kicked out of there.
We're diehards. We're to the end.
To the end.
Yeah.
So.
And there's no Hurricane Katrina coming at us. So, you know, this happens to be an expo that's a safe expo.
Exactly.
Oh, wait, there's microbes flying in the air.
Correct.
You're vaccinated. I'm vaccinated. All right.
Life is good.
Good.
Life is good. Man, I know that you're about to get kicked out of your hotel and need to get back over there. So. I'm not going to tell you he's getting kicked out, you know, for bad behavior, but he does need to get back to the hotel. Two things I want to talk to you about.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk to you about PCRF. We're going to do a blatant plug for PCRF.
Excellent.
And I want you to talk about it. And then I also want to talk about a research poster you did. So let's first off talk the research posters here at EMS Expo. Great showing. There's research all over the place.
42 projects. Incredible.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Love it.
Tell me what the PCRF is, and tell me what this whole thing at Expo was.
So the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum was established in 1992. It's a nonprofit foundation that's it's intended to help EMS providers at all levels get research done, disseminated. So we want to teach people how to do it. We want to help them do it. And then we have a forum, which happens to be in conjunction with this venue, the International Scientific Symposium, where we accept abstracts from anyone who wants to submit them. We have experts blindly judge them and rank them, and that is what we call peer review. So we are able to present original research never seen before at any other venue, any other conference, and not only showcase the stuff that's happening around pre-hospital care, but really kind of take control of our destiny so that it's EMS folks doing EMS research, and we are advancing the profession with evidence, with yep. science. So our attempt, we do podcasts every month, one clinical, one educational, is to make science accessible and understandable. So yep. people don't think of research as a dirty word, as like, I don't know how to do that, I wouldn't know where to begin. It's just curiosity and actually trying to answer questions that have plagued us for a while, so that we can move on. There's groundbreaking stuff. David Wampler won best research, paramedic and PhD. And you don't need to be a PhD, but he happens to have one, so mm-hmm. it's kind of handy. But he did a simple project, taking a camera, putting some dots, watching people move back and forth on yep. a backboard, going, it's less movement if they're on the stretcher. Yep. Or another one that he did with Dr. Miramontes, where they waved an alcohol prepper.
We actually had Dave on the podcast and talked about
nausea. Isn't that amazing?
Yep.
So an EMT can do the same thing that we do with Zofran with just a little bit of an alcohol prep. So rock stars like Dr. Remley Crowe, an EMT and PhD, have won research for burnout and disparities in care this time.
Yep, and she's going to be on the pod.
Love it, love it. And, you know, the work that Ginny Rinkowitz just did on suicide, amazing stuff. But I love some of the most simple ones. You know, when I started coming to the research forum and Dr. Baxter Larman, my mentor, was encouraging research, he just did some real simple experiments. He took three suction machines, he put, you know, some soup there, and he said, okay, which one sucks better? And in fact, it was like really noticeable that we can't get the suction machines to work in the prehospital area, which led to improvements in the size of the tubing and all sorts of ways in which they increased suction. So these things help us advance the profession.
Absolutely. So it's two things.
I could talk about it all day long.
I know, and I love it, and that's the reason I wanted to have you on the pod. You're so passionate about it, and that's just inspiring. It gets other people interested in it. You know, your description of what you're trying to do, translating knowledge, moving it to the field, it almost sounds like you're trying to illuminate the darkness of clinical practice with a bright light of science. we just need Ginger's voice in here to say with science.
I love Ginger. She's amazing.
So I do have to ask you, though. You said this is the International Scientific Symposium.
Yes, it's international.
Were you the one who came up with that abbreviation?
So we did. It's kind of because it sort of sounds bad because it might be like ISIS or something.
That was the point.
ISS, please. Let's not confuse the things, okay?
That was my joke. I was going to tell you.
Yeah, awesome. I know. But it is ISIS a little bit. We're terrorists of science. We want to debunk some of the things that were status quo, and we're going to blow up the status quo.
Well, let's see. So that's PCRF, and you said PCRF is based at UCLA.
Yeah, although it really is a national and international project. And in fact, we have collaborations with the UK College of Paramedics, the Australasian College of Paramedicine, the Paramedic Association of Canada. We're doing a joint online 24-hour marathon of an international symposium. And normally,
this is just madness, man. Hearing
COVID,
about what y'all are doing,
it's like geek out, man.
Yeah.
And we give a prize.
So what do you mean by 24 hours?
24 hours. So they'll get started in the UK. They'll kick it off. If we're awake, you know, working night shift,
right?
You can tune in, and then as the sun goes around the globe, we're going to take turns and get the best research for pre-hospital care to come out in a virtual environment. So we have panels with people from all of these countries all together in one place.
You know, did you talk to Bob Geldof about this? Is this like the research version of We Are the World?
I thought it was awesome. A Jerry Lewis telethon, but you know, whatever.
Same thing. Less annoying.
We're not asking for money, although if you have money, really, we need money for the PCRF. No, really, we need money for the PCRF.
And research, by the way.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Plug, I want to talk about your research. And it's funny you mentioned Remley Crowe.
Rock star.
Yeah. Remley went to EMT school in Mexico.
Yes, she did at the Mexican Red Cross in Mexico City.
See how I did that segue?
Yeah. Smooth.
So I frequently wanted to know, what is the EMT training like in Mexico? And how does it compare?
Similar standards of care for BLS, right?
Yeah, the things that you do.
Correct.
And the things you're expected
to
know.
Exactly. Okay. Very similar scope, very similar depth in what we expect people to know and understand. So we know these are very similar in many ways.
Yep. So tell me how the curricula compares.
Right.
Wouldn't it be great if somebody did a research project that did those? So you did that. If I remember correctly, you were the senior author on it, right?
Well, yes.
Who else was on this paper?
So Alfonso Salas, who is the delegado and in charge of the delegación, or the delegation that of the Red Cross that it takes care of the state of Mexico.
Okay.
And that's important because there's the country of Mexico, there's Mexico City, but then there's the state of Mexico, which is literally the surrounding area around Mexico City. So very urban,
Pardon my lack of understanding of Mexican geography, but is that the same thing as the federal district, the DF?
The federal district is almost like Washington, D.C., yeah. And then the surrounding area is okay. Mexico, the state of Mexico. So just like you have states in the U.S., yeah. Mexico has states. So you're in Chiapas or you're in
Guanajuato. Is that particular Guanajuato. State, is it really pretty
large?
Urban? Is most of it just
so
Mexico City?
It has
bigger?
Everything. It okay. has lots of urban, lots of mountains because Mexico City was in a valley. So you have everything. You have ultra remote and you have ultra urban okay. and very dense or very hard to get to. It's quite fun.
So you compared the curriculum, what they need to know. So the scope, what they actually are expected to do is basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most...
With tiny little bits of difference. They
kind of
can start an IV, for example. So okay. some EMTs in this country get variances and they yeah. get approved to do that.
But usually that's an advanced scope.
It usually is. So there's that little bit of difference. There's also a tiny bit of difference in that off the get-go, they are authorized to do things like just life-saving epinephrine, okay. right, for anaphylaxis or aspirin for MI. So these things are for sure part of their scope from the start.
Okay.
But not spilling into our AMT. So they're not okay. going to do D50. They're not going to. It really doesn't. There's no scope creep. It's pretty much okay. limited to a very few drugs that they're going to do, and maybe a nebulizer, more likely an MDA. So helping patients take their own med.
So when you compared the curriculum in
yes.
different areas, what's
crazy
the bottom
differences.
Line? How long does it take to become?
800 hours in Mexico, yeah. 184 at UCLA.
That's different.
Yeah, a little, you wow. think? And plus 46 weeks for them.
Yeah.
Once they usually do it on Saturdays, so once a week people go in. And most of them are volunteers. The Red Cross has 40,000 volunteers across the country. And that's the backbone of BLS ambulances
yeah.
is volunteers. So these are people who have regular careers and they're coming in once a week during the year. You see great variations, for example, in they do 24 hours of neurology on the at the didactic level, whereas we do 2 hours of
yeah.
neurological emergencies. And they will spend a lot more time, like 138 more hours, doing simulations and do a lot of that, role playing and simulation. They do 154 hours of ride-alongs, I think,
wow.
158, don't quote me exactly, but so they're really hands-on, but they'll do 45 hours of anatomy and physiology, so they have a much stronger base in
yeah.
A&P than we do.
Well, as an A&P nerd, that just is music to my heart. That's amazing. That's really cool. So I always think, I'm a Texan, right? So
yeah.
they're my southern neighbors. I always think it's important to understand how other countries do things. We have a tendency in the U.S. to think our way is the only way and our mm-hmm. way is the best way.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. And I think it's really important to get an idea of what our colleagues do.
And it's very rare to have paramedics in Mexico, like advanced providers. There are very few. The Mexican Red Cross has trained only a few cohorts of,
yeah.
of what we would call a paramedic in the U.S., and they consider that, a depth that really is a 3-year degree. They call it a TSU, Técnico Superior Universitario. And that is a level that is in scope and in knowledge similar to our paramedic, only that they will actually grant a degree.
Nice.
So
that's
very
it's
different.
Typically 3 years.
Yes,
as
3 years.
As opposed to most of our paramedic degree programs are 2 years.
Correct,
nice.
Correct. And in
awesome.
Australia, those are 3-year bachelor programs. In the UK and here, 4 years is a typical bachelor's.
Yeah.
But I've always been amazed at what people call a 3-year program and a 2-year program. Like we cram into 13 months, 12 months, what people would do in
yeah.
3 years, no problem.
Yeah.
And we think it's humane. It's sort of the way residents
exactly.
used to have to sleep
yeah.
on the couch because they were just going,
right.
There's more
a reason
and more
they're
more.
Called house officers.
Yeah, uh-huh, exactly. And then they don't, and we don't give any credit for ride-alongs.
Right.
I mean, come on. That's just, you need
yeah.
to get your skills done and
yep.
go out and get it.
Awesome. Well, this is great information. I really appreciate you talking to us about
yes.
PCRF. Guys, if y'all are interested, and of course you're interested in research because you're listening to this podcast, I really encourage you to submit your research to PCRF.
Mentors are standing by. We have 42 associates that want to mentor others, and we have workshops in conjunction with our partners.
I can't believe we didn't talk about that.
I know, like ESO.
And ESO. Yes,
exactly. And the amount of data there so that people don't have to reinvent the wheel, right? We need to synergize. And we sit in like a think tank environment and say, what do you want to study? And we've had people study some amazing stuff, like are stroke scales effective? Remley Crow helped that team.
So incredible stuff. Plug our, we're doing, so at FAST 23 in Las Vegas, be there because it's going to be great.
Absolutely.
We go there, there's a pre-conference workshop where Dave and his folks come together, Remley and Tony come together with their data. We sit down, we assign people who are interested in a research topic to a group of mentors, and we hash through what are your ideas, what can we figure out, and do a project.
Zero to hero in that workshop.
Yep.
So the idea is instant gratification, like speed dating. In a matter of 2 days, you will do a project, you'll come from an idea to actually project completion, we hope, and then you clean it up sort of on a few, we'll follow you and help you over the course of a year
to
make sure you can submit it and present it and get the full paper done.
And so the plan at FAST, we're going to do this this coming year.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get everybody some abstracts by the end of that session. We go in, we clarify them, we finish the doing full analysis in 2 days is a bit much to ask. Mm-hmm. But we'll do that. It sort of sucks. But it is fun.
Yeah.
It's like a hackathon for statistics nerds.
And you don't go to dinner with us because you're working on the data.
It is true.
We go have fun while you're trying to crunch, the right statistical test and make the data fit.
And the really fun thing is when I try to figure out the right statistical test, I'm calling Remley, and she's getting annoyed because she's doing the exact same thing for another project. But then we work with you over the course of the year. You get the manuscript done, and you come back the next year and present it the next year.
Samuel Kardec did one on ketamine,
and look
at it now. I mean, ketamine is a big issue, and we did that way before it was a big controversy, and we have a story to tell about ketamine, and he's brought that to the forefront.
Absolutely. And he also introduced me to some really cool plotting in R. We're both ggplot fans,
and he really taught me how
to do some great plots.
See, you just went there like it was just
damn
flowing,
straight.
And I'm just
this
going,
is the
this
kind
is
of
Chinese
high-quality
geeky
nerdery
crap
that you expect from the MS Lighthouse Project. Great. Dave, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Let's keep doing it.
I agree.
All right. Thanks, Dave. That was surprising to me as we were sitting here. So much more time spent on what I think is the important stuff, the anatomy and physiology.
Absolutely.
800 hours. I mean, holy mackerel.
Yeah.
I can sort of speak recently about this because my son Caleb just went through EMT class, and it was not 800 hours, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Right? But good stuff.
Yeah. And I really am. I used to teach anatomy and physiology. I am so excited to hear people doing that. I think it's wonderful. And it's a really interesting thing about what do you value? Do you value knowledge or do you value skills?
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like the determine, and I'm not sure there is a right answer, but they, for them, have to determine knowledge is a thing they really want to stress. Our Australian colleagues have done this. Our colleagues in Britain have done this. And we seem to stress skills.
Indeed.
So maybe there's a balance, but I think seeing the contrast is really, really good.
Indeed.
Hey, during that episode, we talked about the pre-conference workshop for FAST. Just tell us one more time when and where.
All right. So FAST 22 coming to you, Las Vegas.
Live in person.
Live in person, May 9th through 11th. At Planet Hollywood. It's going to be amazing. And again, we talked about it, the pre-hospital care research forum, pre-conference. Come to that pre-conference. You're going to meet people. You're going to learn about research. In fact, when that weekend is over, you will have an outline in hand.
Enough to get an abstract.
Enough to get an abstract going.
Yeah.
And you're going to be working with amazing people for the next year.
It'll be great.
And you will be able to come and present your research at the next FAST, at FAST 23. So look into it. Check out flightbridgehead.com. It's going to be awesome and a great opportunity if you're interested.
Yeah. Mikey, this has been so awesome being able to sit down in person with you.
Real life.
And you know what? I think we're going to get at least one more of these. Well, we're definitely going to do something at FAST.
And clearly.
So we'll have that. We'll even be able to do it again right before then in April, because ESO Wave, which will be obviously here in their hometown in Austin.
Austin, yep.
It's a great conference. It's a theoretically it's a user group, but it's actually a lot
more than
more
that now. Yeah.
Oriented to the entire industry. A lot of great research. A lot of stuff there. But you're bringing in the Fire Dog.
I am, yeah. So April 18 through 22 here in Austin, Fire Dog will be here. We're going to be doing a live podcast lounge. We're going to be doing some audio and video stuff. It's going to be awesome. So obviously I'll see you there.
Absolutely.
Number 2 is going to be there. There's going to be a bunch of people there. All of our good friends are going to be there. You should be there too.
You really
should. And then we'll actually see each other one more time right after that at IAC in Lake Placid.
Oh, yes.
And then we'll be in Vegas. So that's going to be a busy couple of months right there.
It is. And I'm really looking forward to that because, first off, IAC, that was my first post-plague, well, I can't really say post because it's still here, but
true.
The first time I got to get out and see people in person, it was wonderful. And on top of that, I got to meet the folks there, and they are really, really good people.
Yeah, it's a great conference. If you want to get to upstate New York, you want to come to Lake Placid, definitely check it out. Initial Assessment Conference, IAC.
It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Cool.
Well, guys, I think we need to wrap it up. You are back to Formula One tomorrow.
Indeed.
And I am off on, hopefully, seeing how my travel luck holds. I'm on a plane for Boston for ASAP tomorrow morning. Hopefully, it'll be good. Maybe I'll see some of y'all there.
Yeah.
Let's take it out, shall we?
Okay. All right. Well, on behalf of Dr. Jeff Jarvis, Mike Verkest signing off, at least for the final time for a while. You've been watching and listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, proud member of the Flight Brigade Podcast Network, and
a Fire Dog production.
Okay. We'll see you guys on the next one.
Take care,
bye.
Y'all.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the Flight Brigade podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit flightbrigade.com for more information.